What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Hurry into Menards right now and save big money. Miracle-Gro Raised Bed Soil helps you grow bigger, more bountiful plants. It provides the right foundation your plants need to thrive with a 100% organic formula that requires no mixing. Add Miracle-Gro Raised Bed Soil to help your plants grow with organic nutrients you can count on. Visit our garden center or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Wye Valley isn't a typical place for a rock story to begin, but when Echo and the Bunnymen hit the studio to record their groundbreaking debut album, Crocodiles, it was anything but ordinary. The album was the making of the band cultivating a cult following, which would soon evolve into staggering mainstream success. The lives would never be the same again. Following up from the Sunday Times bestseller, Bunnymen, Will Sargent has done it again with Echoes and Memoir Continued. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, Will Sargent. Will, good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon.
Thanks.
Hello, camper.
Good to have you with. For those who think that the 80s was all sort of big hair and big shoulder pads and Pepsi and Shirley and all that sort of stuff, if you were from somewhere north of Watford, it was a different sort of viewpoint, wasn't it?
There was stuff everywhere. There was like the subway sectors, you know, people like that, Wire, you know, Gang of Four, Joy Division, you know, New Order, all them bands, you know, none of them were kind of like cheesy pop shit.
Yeah. Exactly. So tell us a little bit about how, because you covered some of the ground in Bunnymen, but for those who don't know, how Echo and the Bunnymen formed and got together and ended up making that first album.
How we formed?
Yeah.
We were to a club in Liverpool called Eric's, which was like the sort of local punk club, and like punk was kind of like this was exploding at the time. And the first night I went there, Les Pattinson and Paul Simpson were in there, who were in my school. In fact, Les was in my class at school. I hadn't seen him for about 5 years. So that was kind of, I instantly had a couple of mates. You know, I went there on my own because just to see bands or whatever. And so I instantly had some mates to go and see, and, you know, felt a bit more relaxed about going to a, you know, dingy club on your own, you know, when you're like 18 or whatever it was. Probably 19. So we just sort of used to go every week and watch the bands. Everybody was on from The Clash to bloody, don't know, Lena Lovitch. I don't know. The Police, everybody was on. You know, we saw everybody, Wire, Gang of Four, Peru Boo, Devo, Suicide. What goes on for, you know, it was just an amazing. Every week there was bands on, Ramones, Talking Heads and all that. You know, I missed them, by the way, because I was too spotty. We just, you know, everybody seemed to be just starting bands. It was just kind of like the thing that you did. All of a sudden, punk had kicked open the doors. You didn't have to be a virtuoso guitarist or some amazing musician to be in a band. You can learn a couple of chords, thrash away, do a bit of shouting, and you were a band, you know. So we just sort of me and Mac first just started like playing stuff together, and I had a drum machine. We used to record things in my dad's back garden.
I was going to say you could get a drum machine off a Argos catalog, couldn't you? So many art students I knew, you know, went to Argos, got the drum machine off the catalog or Technics or whatever, and started sort of like two man or three people bands.
Yeah, it was like kind of a new thing then. It was very primitive. I didn't get it out of a catalog. I got it from a music shop. It was a very primitive thing. We only used two beats that were, you know, there was Rock 1 and Rock 2. Or in Bossa Nova or whatever, it sounded a bit cheesy. But we did throw it in here and there. But Yeah, so but the band really took off when Pete De Freitas joined in 1979, and that's where the book starts, the new book. Like, meeting Pete De Freitas for the first time, rehearsing with him, you know, and taking it from there. It's just like, you know, that I don't think we would have... We got some attention because we had a drum machine, I think, you know. But I think we wouldn't have, you know, we wouldn't have ended up like Depeche Mode or somebody, you know what I mean, like one of these electronic bands, because... just wouldn't have worked. We always sort of wanted a drummer, really. But there wasn't that many in Liverpool, you know, that weren't already taken, you know. So it was great getting Pete. And he was from out of town. He was from Goring-on-Thames. And he was kind of a posh kid. It was kind of like we had this exotic creature in our band
from, you know, from outside Liverpool. I mean, how did you reel him in? Had he moved up there? He was looking for somewhere to play.
He's only 18, and he was set to go to Oxford or Cambridge. He'd passed all that stuff, you know, the Oxbridge exam or whatever. He's a pretty smart kid, you know. He's clever. He could speak French fluently. He knew about stuff like wine and things, you know. I knew about wine gums. That's about it. Like, and it was just great having somebody that was different to the rest of the Scallies in Liverpool. You know, it was like it was on a different level, sort of thing. You know, it was like made everything seem unusual. And like, you know, the Bunny Men were all about being unusual. We didn't want to do what everybody else did. Like, we play strange places and we went about things in a different way. We thought, anyway, you know, like that's what we sort of purposely, consciously wanted to do.
Well, the sound was different from everybody else who was either being full on gothic or you know, full on sort of rock. I mean, and the hair. I mean, let's talk. Some of the hair was quite interesting as well.
Yeah, well, we all had the Goring's haircuts. Max got this amazing spiky kind of Bowie-ish thing. Pete's was the sort of floppy. Public school boy kind of fop look. I had like the Brian Jones style, Brian Jones bowl, and Les had a kind of amazing quiff that, like, you know, Elvis would have been proud of, you know. So it was kind of, the hair was important, but we weren't like Kajagoogoo, you know, or Clocksy with them, you know, really out their haircuts.
So, I mean, when you're playing in Liverpool, which is a town, you know, I mean, Liverpool's now changed beyond all recognition. It's a brilliant, great tourist site, etc. But when you were playing in Liverpool, because of its history, is it a difficult place to crack, if you like? I mean, if you're playing in Liverpool, you know, there's the long shadow, if you like, of the Beatles hanging over you.
Yeah, that's there all the time. But we weren't trying to crack anything. It wasn't like, oh, we'll crack something. You know, it was just. We were doing it for ourselves. That was it, really. You know, it wasn't like, well, me anyway. I can only speak for me, really. But, you know, I was just doing it because I enjoyed doing it. And it was, like, interesting. And it was kind of hip and something new to do. And I was interested in music. You know, I wasn't really interested in going on Top of the Pops or any of that rubbish. You know, I wasn't bothered. In fact, on Top of the Pops, I wasn't even there. I vanished to the Lake District and the others were... I had to go and somebody had to dress up as me.
you had a stand-in, like a stuntman.
He had a fish, like a fish mask on, because we'd just done a video for Seven Seas. And our roadie, Jake, went and stood in for me because I'd vanished off to the Lake District. Mac had a right gob on him. We were playing football on the Wednesday night and he came storming over. Well, where were you?
How did you get, if you like, spotted? I mean, how did the record deal come along, and what was it like going into the studio?
The record labels were like in a panic because all of a sudden all the music had gone kind of indie and everything was getting rejected. You know, even the big labels started pretend to be small labels. You know, like our label, Corova. Everyone thought it was like an indie label, but it wasn't. It was just part of the Warner's machine, you know, Warner Brothers, WEA, Warner Electra Asylum or whatever. And it was just like, shit, we better make something like that looks cool, you know. So, and there was loads of that sort of stuff going on. Radar Records was the same. I think, you know, they were in a panic because it was all getting rejected by the bands, you know, all this big music business stuff. And one of the great things about what punk did was it changed the contracts. Punk rock, basically, if you got an advance, it was returnable. So if you didn't get anywhere, you had to give them the money back. You know, you ended up with, like, you know, people having crazy debts for the rest of their lives. But after punk, it sort of changed everything. It was like recoupable, non-returnable. So they could recoup it by selling records, but you didn't have to give them the money back or sell the guitars that you just bought to give them the money back. You know, you could still carry on, kind of thing, and try and find all the labels or whatever. It was just different, and record labels used to stick with bands a lot longer. I think, you know, it was kind of, it was a good time, really. And the punk stuff really gave it a good kick up the arse, really.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot. All the bands.
And also, because you were talking about the bands you'd seen, and you know, Devo, for example, and the bands you didn't see, like, you know, Talking Heads, but they evolved. That was the new wave. And then we got into what was happening in the early 80s, which had kind of been missed by, you know, most of the UK music scene. But you had, like, breakthroughs like Depeche Mode, Yazoo, that sort of stuff. And then you had what was happening up in the Midlands and the North and up in Sheffield with Human League, etc. And it sort of caught them out a bit by the whole look, didn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, there was. It was after punk. Like, you couldn't be just doing punk forever. You can't be that angry forever. You know, it's just become boring. You know, so things were developing, but they were sort of not going back as far as progressive rock. But a lot of it is, I think. You know, some of these bands nowadays, like Radiohead, I think they're progressive rock. They are. You know, they could be Pink Floyd, couldn't they? You know, and When it was the punk thing happened, it was like everybody was against that. But what they're forgetting is, in the late 60s, early 70s, that was the freaky music. You know, the Emerson, Lake and Palmers and Yes and all that sort of stuff. That was like, all the weirdos were into that in your class at school. They were like the sort of goths of the time or whatever, you know. I remember there was four of us in our class and we liked all that stuff, and everybody else was like into all the pop stuff, Chicory Tip and Middle of the Road and all that rubbish, you know. So it was kind of like we were seen as the four freaks in the corner. But it was, you know, it was like this stuff that was punk was trying to kick out. But without that, punk wouldn't have happened. You know, the overblown kind of two-ton drum kits and, you know, 15 articulated lorries taking... You know, all the stuff.
Three-year keyboard solos, yeah.
But, you know, I still play all that stuff, and it's from when I was a kid. You love the stuff that when you were a kid, you know, when you were 14, 15, and it still remains with you, and it doesn't matter whether it's Northern Soul or, you know.
But the thing is, if it's the music that shaped you and you like it, just like it. You don't have to be... I mean, there's nothing worse than people saying, oh, I like this because it's a rare import from Finland on a B-side.
I reject your history, I don't think. You know what I mean? Like, people, oh, I never liked them. Well, yeah, you did. You had Topographic Oceans. Rubbish. It's like, you know, you had Uriah Heep. I saw it in your record collection. Yeah, but I never really liked it. Well, yeah, you did. Because there was nothing else. There was that or, you know, Mud.
Oh, I think I'm going to say shwaddy waddy for a minute, which we have to sort of, you know, shut the interview down. What point was it that you suddenly realised that you'd become, you know, you were people were putting your posters on the walls, and I wouldn't say mainstream because you never went out to go, hi, here's the Christmas album, but, you know, because of the look and because of the music, which was, you know, and it's an intelligent music as well. You were getting people to read stuff and think about stuff.
It was a gradual rise, really, but it was quite quick compared to some things, you know. And it just seemed to be, weirdly and arrogantly, you just thought, yeah, of course, you know, of course, we're like playing Wembley, you know, arena, not stadium, and, you know, the Albert Hall or whatever, you know. It just seemed like, well, we're the best band in the world, so we should be, you know. It was kind of like a real... It's like a Liverpool thing, I think. There's like a real cocky arrogance going on, but it's... You know, it just, I don't know, it's just kind of, it's just the way it is, you know.
And so when it came to going to, because the book deals with it, with your time in the States as well. So when you came to doing the States, I mean,
yeah,
that's a different, I mean, they were thoroughly AOR, aren't they? And it's the big hair metal phase as well. So it's, you know, it's an interesting time to be, it's Footloose, isn't it? And all that sort of stuff and Flashdance.
Yeah. Yeah, but you've got to remember there was college radio stations in America. Every city had a college radio station, and that was run by the, you know, the four freaks in the corner in the class. So they were playing, like, you know, Wall of Voodoo or whoever, you know. So, you know, it, there was an opening there for unusual music, or, you know, not so much mainstream stuff, you know. So, and that, and every city had that, and it all linked up. You know, the thing with America is it's massive, but there's loads of, like, cities. Well, there's loads of cities we never go to. You know, Columbus, Ohio, or bloody Miami. We don't even go there. You know, we never go anywhere. We go to, like, all the main places, you know, New York, Chicago, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, that sort of thing. That's, but I'm always banging on about it. Why aren't we playing, you know, Boise, Idaho? You know, there's still massive cities bigger than Liverpool, you know, but it's one of them things. That's how U2 got so big. They played all of them places, well, several times.
All the little stadium, all the off the road ones.
It just worked and worked and worked. We would only do like 6 weeks maximum in America before we, you know, went a bit crazy.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because if you're on a tour that big, and you may all be mates, but, you know, as you said, it's big. It's not doing like doing a European tour where you can maybe nip back for a weekend. I mean, you're there, you're together. I mean, several bands have exploded or gone completely over the top on whether they can get their hands on, be it animal, vegetable, mineral, or chemical.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, just part of the thing, isn't it?
What's it like being Echo and the Bunnymen in Los Angeles? Was it any different walking into the Whiskey A Go-Go than the Royal Albert Hall then?
The Whiskey A Go-Go was more important to me because that's where the Doors started out, you know, as the house band.
Yeah.
It was a massive house band before the band, you know, in the 70s, you know. From the first time I heard Strange Days, really, in my brother's house in Pinner in about 1971 or whenever. That was... Like, I was, like, chuffed about doing the whiskey. Yeah. It's only a small little place like Eric's, you know. It's got a high ceiling.
Yeah.
They'd go, you know, go-go dancers in it. But we, not when we were there, but we used to in the 60s, you know. Male and female.
Yeah, of course. Of course. I'm just trying to think of what a go-go dancer for Echo and the Bunnymen would look like.
Be like a bunny girl, wouldn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think so. Pretty much so. And also, you know, the music doesn't, I mean, as I always say, nothing exists in a vacuum. Especially music, especially when you're, you know, getting broadcast to people on the radio, you know, in a time before streaming or whatever. And 80s in the UK was a time of real upheaval, especially for anybody from, as I said before, from the Midlands and the North and wherever else. And it was a challenging time.
Oh, yeah. Well, we went on tour. When I came back, my bank had been burnt down. In Toxteth, you know, the bank where I thought they burnt all my money, whatever there was, like 20 quid or whatever. But it was like, it was completely changed because we were away on tour when them, like, Liverpool riots kicked off, you know, and I lived in Toxteth at the time with Ian Brody. And it was just weird. Half of it was burned down. Lodge Lane was a mess, you know.
And so
stuff like that, you know, a lot of like at one point the council were thinking about letting people bury their own dead because the grave diggers were on strike.
Yeah,
so, like a lot of people, you know, bits you can bury Uncle Arthur down there, and it was only because the strike deadlock kind of broke that it never happened. But that's what was it was that the bodies were mounting up.
And so against that, it's a bit difficult to go on Top of the Pops or appear in Looking or Smash Hits or something and be nice and poppy.
We just, it was just normal, wasn't it, for us? We just, you know, you just get used to whatever, don't you? You know, it's like, look, the first book, I it's all about growing up as a kid, and our family was a bit mental. And a lot of that violence and, you know, aggro in the home and all that. But to me, it was just normal. It was just, that's the way it was. Because you just grow up with it, you know.
Mm. And so when it comes to sort of the mid-80s, and you've got pretty, you know, Killing Moon, Cutter, things like that, which become, you know, even now you can play, well, you've got very dedicated fans. I mean, is it, and you're still out there, and you're still doing, obviously, you know, you're live and kicking. Is it, yeah. You look back to that, and then you look back to the songs that have, you know, that still sound fresh. I mean, what is it like to get asked to play things like, you know, The Cutter, for example, or Killing Moon?
I love playing them,
yeah.
Because they never become stale to me, because it's such a nervous thing to stand on a stage and, like, get all the notes in the right order and play them at the right time. Not all the right, all the right notes, not necessarily in the right order, kind of thing. You know, you're so kind of het up about it all that, you know, it's kind of, it's like satisfying to get it right, you know. And it's never the same twice anyway, because it's, you know, things change. Like, you know, someone might miss something, or there might be some slight deviation in what you play. And it kind of keeps it interesting, you know.
When I talk to musicians who've been doing this for a while, and I was talking to the guy from Anthrax a couple of weeks ago, and he said the greatest thing he's got is, you know, because they're bringing their kids and their grandkids maybe even now. And he says the thing is, it's the connection that we have with an audience. It's not about it's not about the social media hits. It's not about the we sold this many albums or I've got a, whatever I drive. It's when you look out there and you realize that you are playing or speaking or singing to that person.
Yeah, it's corny. It's very Cliff Richard, the whole thing, but that's the way it is. It's like playing live is the best part of the job by a long way, you know, because of the nervous adrenaline and, you know, and the crowd, and it's like you're in it together. It's not just the band on the stage, and that the crowd can dictate how it goes. They can raise you up or bring you down if they're not into it, you know, which doesn't happen often, like, but, you know, it can happen.
When it was, you know, back in the day, what was, you know, Hunter S. Thompson calls it the high water mark, you know, where he sees where the hippie movement hit Ashbury in what, 67? Was there a point where you were, you know, with Echo the Bunny Wayne, where you stood and thought, this is, you know, not the Albert Hall, because you think, oh, this is easy, but it was a point you stood around and went, this is not bad?
Oh, God. That's a hard one, Matt. Because there's layers to it, you know. As you're going along, getting in the Enemy was great. You know, John Peel playing our record, that was like another fight, you know, and so it keeps going like that. And then the tide starts going out. And, like, you know, then it starts getting a bit rubbish. And, like, you start, even if you're getting bigger, you know, even when you're playing, like we played the Greek Theater in Los Angeles, which is a big place. It's an outdoor kind of amphitheater place. I remember me and Les and Pete, we went out and we were, like, wandering around the crowd, and it was all, like, 15-year-old girls. And none of them knew who we were or anything. We just went for a walk about. It's like, this is weird. We were expecting, you know, slightly older kind of ex-punks.
Yeah.
All kind of, you know, Valley Girl types. And it was, that was a bit of a shock. So that's when it was, even though we were big, it was like, I'm not sure I'm into this anymore.
But yeah. That's when you go from almost from the beginnings to the mainstream, and people just like you because you're a big band and you look a bit, you know, and the music is a bit different, quote unquote.
And it was becoming a bit like too pop starry. You know, nobody knew who Mac was. That was it. You know, that's all they were interested in. You know, I mean, you know, I'm not about musically, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a bit weird. But, you know, we still played the Greek Theatre and it was great. You know, it was an amazing place. I'd like to go back there.
So, I mean, you wrote the first book, Bunny Man. So, are we getting a trilogy here, or is it, or even more, or is this the second? Is the second one going to be the last one, you think?
I always planned on doing three because the story's too. Unless you had like a great big fat book like that, which would be boring. I've always planned on doing three. So, but you know, who knows? Like, the next one's going to be Porcupine, touring Iceland. Like, me and Les went on holiday to Russia when Andropov was in charge, you know. Wow. So there's going to be a lot of that. I've got loads of great photos of that trip. You know, recording in Paris, you know, so there's a lot of stories. Like, me and Les used to, because in a band, you kind of team up. Like, there was Jake and Pete. They were mates, and they both went to, private school. So they were kind of like the toffs. And then there was me and Les, who were in the same class at school, so we were mates. And then there was Mark, who with the manager or the tour manager or whatever. So, because you didn't all, we did go out together sometimes, but most of the time you just teamed up, because it was just gets too complicated. You're in the foyer of the hotel waiting for 10 people to turn up. And it's like, by the time they turn up, you know, the pubs are shut or whatever, you know. you need to get on with it. So, what was the original question? I do this a lot. I'll go off on it.
This is a radio presenter's dream. Honestly, on a Friday afternoon, this is a radio presenter. I'm just sitting here and listening to you, mate. This is absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
I'll go off on one.
The trilogy. Yeah. Is it going to be, are we going to have the Return of the King, basically? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the third one's going to be about, like, Porcupine, yeah. Ocean Ray, Gordon in Paris, being less cycling around Paris, cobbly streets, you know, going up to the Forum and all that sort of stuff. It was great. You know, we took our push bikes with us and we were Parisians for a couple of weeks. We were there 3 weeks. The studio was like one of these real old school studios called Studio Des Dames. I don't even think it's there anymore. And it was just this door, and you went inside and it was like kind of real old school BBC.
Okay.
You know, old-fashioned equipment and lots of things with valves. And they had this amazing plate reverb, which everything sounded great. It sounded like a Scott Walker album instantly as soon as you put it through this thing. It was just great. And we had a French engineer and a tape op. But, you know, the great thing about it was Pete could speak French. So he was kind of our... can we put bass on that? And he would say, you know, say it in French, you know. Right?
Yeah, and swirling around with Garoir and basically getting into the whole vibe, yeah?
Yeah. And we had a French string arranger lined up who'd done, you know, Charles Aznavour or whatever. And, yeah, I'm sure he was brilliant. But we met him when we went for a meal. It was lunch, it was. And we didn't like him. He was more arrogant than us. So it was like, me and Max said, like in the journey. So he was out the window. And we got our mate, Adam Peters, who played cello on some of I can't remember the first track he played cello on. But he was like a music school kid. And he was kind of like up and coming. He does movie soundtracks now, you know. And we got him over. He said, yeah, I'll come over. He was only like a kid, you know. And he did all the string arrangements, you know. And it's brilliant. You know, they're absolutely brilliant. And he had our same sort of influences and stuff. So his take on it would have been completely different to sounding like Charles Aznavour.
Echo and the Bunnymen do this Charles Aznavour sessions. One of the great unmade albums of our time, Will.
It might have been great. Like, some of them things are brilliant. So, you know, I love all Serge Gainsbourg stuff and all that, you know. It's Gainsbourg. you know, but that's the way it went. We ended up with Adam, and it was great.
And it turned out quite well. The book is called Echoes, A Memoir Continued. It's by Will Sargent, who I've been speaking to today. Will, I've got to let you go because I've got to go to the news in 10 minutes over here in Spain.
I'll be mates in the pub already.
Oh, you should have told me 5 minutes ago, I would have cut it short. If people want to find you online, if people want to find you, what are you up to this weekend, by the way? You're coming to Spain, aren't you? Sorry, I forgot to mention.
Yeah, we're playing in Valencia.
Yeah.
I don't know. Barcelona and Madrid.
Just don't say hello, Spain, when you're playing Barcelona. There's a whole load of trouble.
Oh, right, yeah. The Catalan.
Oh, yeah.
Catalonia. Yeah. Okay, hello. Yeah.
That'll get you a drink in the bar.
If people want to find you
online, then where, because the website's up and running, is it? And in you personally?
My website is getting a bit of tinkering, but the Bunnymen website's there, bunnymen.com. I'm on Twitter and I'm on that new thing, Threads and all that. Just search me, you know. And Instagram, it's Sergeant SGT Will Fuzz on Instagram, because my Instagram got hacked. Somebody
hacked your Instagram?
You know, and like started putting adverts for Bitcoins all over it. And like people were going, oh, I went on your Instagram and I put a voodoo hex on them. So they'll have seen their arse.
the very thought of Will Sergeant promoting cryptocurrency is again one of the great unknown albums of our time. That should go with the Charles Avenue or String Quartet, shouldn't it? And we also do Bitcoin.
Yeah.
The book is called Echoes.
I just think a couple of people fell for it. I went on the thing and I'm like, are you mental? Like, you know, it's fucking stupid. I'm sorry, can't swear, can I?
Well, you just did, so it's okay. It's live. Well, if people want to check you out, and not for cryptocurrency listeners, it's Sergeant William Fuzz, isn't it?
SGC Will Fuzz.
And the Bunnymen is up and running as well.
But yeah, the main one I do is Twitter, really.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it's called nowadays, the old Elon Musk thing.
Yeah. X Musk. The book is also going to be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore, so they can download it straight after this interview. This book.
Yeah. I've finished the Audible thing as well. Oh. That was hardware.
I can imagine. The book is called Echoes, A Memoir Continued. I'm going to run out of time. It's by Will Sergeant. Will, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Yes, thanks a lot, and nice one.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear. Strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/Ohio's time.